This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Dmitri Shostakovich spent almost 40 years living, as he put it, afraid of the knock on the door. In 1936, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin had decided to see what all the fuss was about and went to a performance of Shostakovich's then-successful opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk. The next day, an editorial appeared under Stalin's name in the newspaper Pravda, calling the opera chaos instead of music, and basically laying down the law for Soviet artists. Henceforth, their art had to make a political or ideological statement in service of the state, and of course, it had to be the correct statement. So Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Khachaturian, and others were bullied into producing blandly melodic and formulaic works for public consumption. Privately, though, for most of them, it was a different story. Over the years, Shostakovich fell in and out of favor with Stalin's apparatchiks and the Soviet Composers Union several times, winning medals but also suffering public humiliations. Even after Stalin's death in 1953, Shostakovich never felt he could completely relax, as if he were afraid that any kind of thaw in the government's relations with its artists would only be temporary. He wrote two more propaganda symphonies before he finally let his guard down. His Symphony No. 13 is based on some provocative text by the controversial poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko. No. 14 was a cycle of songs about death, pretty far removed from the official optimism of public Soviet art. Despite this seeming betrayal of its principles, the government found it more useful or politic to exploit Shostakovich than to harass him, and he was loaded with honors at home as well as abroad. In his last years, he began to turn inward, devoting most of his energy to songs and chamber music. But in 1971, 4 years before his death, he finished his 15th and final symphony, a work that seemed to sum up his life and career in one grand and yet enigmatic statement. The symphony starts brightly. With a flute bouncing through a slightly skewed tune over the unusual combination of glockenspiel and plucked strings. Shostakovich symphonies often begin with long, meandering melodies, usually solemn ones. This one goes on for a while, and it has been suggested that the composer was making fun of those long, low, slowly wandering themes. The rhythm and tempo pick up and send the music right into the march from Rossini's William Tell Overture. Shostakovich often quoted himself, particularly in the last years of his life, and he does so several times in this work. But making so obvious a reference to so well-known a tune by someone else is unusual. The program note at the first performance explained that this movement depicts a toy shop at night, with the toys all springing to life in their keeper's absence. Four times, the toys either reel out of control or begin to break down. Each time, the William Tell theme brings them back. Some commentators have considered Shostakovich's program far too disingenuous for a man who'd been through all that he had. William Tell was, after all, a famous freedom fighter. Is Shostakovich suggesting that the feeble efforts of a composer are no match for a real hero, Or is he ironically using William Tell's theme to represent the government cracking down on the people when they get out of line? In the book Testimony, which may or may not be his memoirs, Shostakovich says that the music of his 15th symphony is tied to his plans for an opera based on Anton Chekhov's study of megalomania, The Black Monk. Shostakovich makes it clear that the wry, clear-sighted, and philosophical Chekhov was the artist who meant most to him, and whose work, whose very style of existence, sustained and nourished him most. Just one more piece of evidence that the William Tell reference could not possibly be as trivial as the composer so carefully makes it seem. In the second movement, Adagio, Shostakovich quotes the first movement of his own Symphony No. 11, also an Adagio. He wrote his 11th symphony for the 40th anniversary of the October Revolution of 1917, but the work portrays the Bloody Sunday in 1905, when thousands of workers and intellectuals with their families were slaughtered by the Tsar's guards during a peaceful protest. Shostakovich may have said he was writing about Nicholas II, but he was not forgetting the tyrants who had replaced the Tsar. The soft contour of the brass chorale contrasts with the 12-tone melodies sung by the solo cello, and the solo violin. In his later works, Shostakovich often used 12-tone melodies in the context of death and despair. Things get even more explicit, though, when the dialogue between the string soloists and the brass leads to a funeral march. Which ranges from the height of anguish to the depths of despair. And the celesta chills the atmosphere even further by quoting the cello theme in inversion, upside down. Transforming the theme completely. The brass chorale returns and the movement devolves to a simple rolling timpani. Then, without break, the adagio dissolves into the kind of sardonic scherzo that Shostakovich was famous for. The trumpets try to turn it into something nobler. but the trombones just sneer. Meanwhile, the composer himself puts in an appearance with the DSCH motto that occurs so often in his later music. Shostakovich uses the German transliteration of his name, which begins with SCH, and the German names for the musical notes. D, E flat, C, B becomes D, S, C, H. Dmitri Shostakovich. And the movement ends in a mysterious chatter of percussion. To start the finale, Shostakovich again reaches into a world of familiar music with deep associations, the solemn sequence of brass chords from the Annunciation of Death scene in Act II of Wagner's Die Walküre. In that scene, Brünnhilde appears before Sigmund to tell him that she only appears to those about to die in battle. Wagner brings the theme back in the final act of Götterdämmerung, and each time it is followed by noble or passionate music. In this symphony, Shostakovich follows the quotation with another meandering tune and another Wagner reference, the opening notes of Tristan and Isolde, Music of Grief. The climax of the movement is a dark twist on a passage from his heroic Leningrad Symphony. A work which, according to testimony, is not about Leningrad under siege. It's about the Leningrad that Stalin destroyed and that Hitler merely finished off. After the return of several themes from earlier in the symphony, including the funerary brass, the Tristan melody returns. It grows more and more lyrical until the brass intrude. And eventually, the symphony ends with the strings softly holding a single ambiguous chord. Is it major or minor? While the percussion clacks and pings and patters away, the xylophone finally turns the string's open chord to a clear A major, and with a bell tone, quiet and bright, it all fades away. Shostakovich's final symphony does seem to sum up his life and his art, the way Beethoven and Brahms did in their symphonic finales. But did the quotations Shostakovich sprinkled throughout the symphony reveal him, or were they one more set of masks to hide behind? He told a friend in his later years that, without party guidance, I would have displayed more brilliance, used more sarcasm. I could have revealed my ideas openly instead of having to resort to camouflage. In his Symphony No. 15, it's still not clear if he finally did. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.